Welcome to 3GT, the podcast for three guys, a pastor, a professor, and a parishioner discuss theology from a practical standpoint, all from a Reformed perspective. Find out more at 3GT.xyz.
Thank you for joining us on another episode of Three Guys Theologizing. Those three guys are Shepherd Kyle Borg from Winchester, Kansas, attorney Scott Hunt from Marion, Indiana, and this is Barry York, president of Reformed Presbyterian Theological Seminary out in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're glad you've joined us today for this topic, this discussion that we're going to have, and we're actually going to talk about another denomination, which we don't often do, but we're going to do that today. And that denomination is the United Methodist Church. And that might be surprising that some Reformed guys would talk about the United Methodist Church, but it does remain a fairly influential denomination in our land, despite the decline of mainline denominations. There's still many, many people that identify and belong to the United Methodist Church. You usually find one, if not many, congregations in any given community. And part of the reason that we're going to discuss them today is at the end of February, they had their quadrennial meeting where they had a major vote that grabbed the attention not only of Christian news outlets, but also the secular media. And they also voted in a surprising way. I think many of us would have thought that as they came to vote on what they believed regarding same-sex marriage and gay clergy and things of that nature, we might have thought that the dominoes would keep falling, so to speak, that we've seen in other more liberal denominations. But lo and behold, in their vote, they voted to maintain their traditional stance against same-sex marriage. And so that, again, was quite surprising. And so we want to interact with this decision a bit and what that might mean. And wanted to start off asking if you men have been following this discussion. I think, Kyle, you mentioned that you actually did spend some time watching even maybe you're listening to some of the deliberations. I didn't have the opportunity to do that. I just read on it some. And so maybe you could share a few of your thoughts, and then Scott, you can chime in.
Yeah, so I followed with a lot of attention for multiple reasons, not the least of which, in the rural community where I live and where I minister, we have a very good, friendly relationship with the local United Methodist Church, and we do certain joint activities throughout the year. And to be honest, as a pastor, I've been somewhat hesitant. I've been nervous because the United Methodist Church has become more progressive, more theologically liberal. And I do wonder at some point, when will our friendly relationship, when will we need to kind of maybe hit a little bit of a pause on that? And so this was a big question. You know, if this denomination were to affirm the LGBTQ community, if they were to say same-sex marriage is lawful in the eyes of God and it's something we are to celebrate and to support, if they were to back the ordination of gay clergy, which is what one of the plans that was put forward, that would have ramifications for my local ministry. That would require some thinking through what does it look like to continue to work in a community like this with a church that I would now regard as saying what is evil is actually good. And so I that's part of the reason. I'm also a bit of an ecclesiastical nerd. And so when I found out they were live streaming the general conference, I thought, hey, I'll tune in. And so I did. I watched a number of hours of some of the debates and the discussions that were going on. And a lot of it was procedural, but when they got to the substance of the debate, I was also very, very interested in the talking points that were put forward, primarily because I think so many of them represented American Christianity, broadly and generally defined. And American Christianity is a very interesting, very it's a very critical situation that we're facing in American religion. And so I thought a lot of those comments were very reflective to begin to understand, you know, how are people approaching issues like this, and where are they ceding? Where are they yielding too much to culture in the world? So that was interesting to me. So anyway, I watched several hours, and I followed the news, and I read reactions and commentators on the general conference.
Wow. How about you, Scott? Have you followed along or felt that this would be impactful to you and your local area and ministry?
I can't say I followed it with nearly as much fervor as Kyle did. I did not take time off from my regularly scheduled work to sit and watch deliberations of another denomination.
I didn't take time off work either. I watched in the morning. So
okay, well, unfortunately, in the morning I'm at work, and that's fine. I'm just giving you a hard time. I did not follow it.
Pastors just work closely on Sundays. Wait.
Well, that's right. You only work on Sunday morning, right, Kyle? Isn't that how it goes?
That's right. That's right.
I was aware of the situation. I was aware of what was being discussed. Generally, I'm aware of the outcome. I don't know a whole lot of specifics. I've read a couple of articles about it, but that's about as deep as I go. What I find interesting is, and maybe we'll talk on this a little bit later, it was not the American church that ultimately upheld the standard. It was churches from Africa and people from Africa who were voting on this that seemed to put this over the top to keep the church with its traditional views of marriage and ordaining ordination. So I just thought that was really telling about the church in America and where this denomination really stands.
Yes, the overall vote was very narrow. It wasn't like it was a convincing majority that voted for this. I think the percentages were 53% upheld traditional marriage and 47% opposed. So not quite an even split, but pretty close to it. And I think that's right, Kyle. Is it not that it was the African delegates that really held the conservative side of things?
The African delegates definitely got the most press, but I personally, from my reading and watching, it was the international community. So one of the unique things about the United Methodist Church, unlike most mainline denominations, it is a global church. And so it is globally represented, and it's not just an American denomination. And it was the international community. The African church was the most vocal, but the Russian church also came out very strongly against the same-sex approbation.
Okay. And from reports I read, and even actually some of the quotes, I think it was some African bishops that really spoke strongly on the conservative side. And it was interesting in some of the quotes I read, those delegates would be quoting from scripture and referring to the Bible. And then when you listen to a lot of the American delegates trying to support the LGBTQ side of things, it was more emotional appeals and how long I've been in the denomination, and an appeal to the new generation, the youth of the church. It was more emotional appeals rather than biblical ones. But you listened to more of it than I did, Kyle, because I didn't listen to any of it. I just I just read on it.
You were at work too. You were busy being industrious. So
no, but did you have any quotes or snapshots that you might share with us and things that you saw as you watched?
Yeah. So with regard specifically to the African bishops, there was a prayer meeting on the Saturday morning of the general conference. And one of the very widely reported news stories was one of the African pastors. Well, he's actually, I think he was he's the president of a theological seminary in Liberia. And he came out very strongly against this change of the church's stance. And what he said is, let me grab the quote here real quick. It's a very powerful quote. He says, "And please hear me when I say as graciously as I can, we Africans are not children in need of Western enlightenment when it comes to the church's sexual ethics. We do not need to hear a progressive U.S. bishop lecture us about our need to grow up. Let me assure you, we Africans, whether we like it or not, have had to engage in this debate for many years now. We stand with the global church, not a culturally liberal church elite in the U.S. And that whole statement just is a punch in the gut. And I think as I've reflected on that, simultaneously, I want to cheer it. But I also, as a member of the broader American church, that can't, you know, I can't simply just pat them on the back and say, yeah, you go get them. I think he's summarizing what has really happened to the broader American church, where it has sold out to the culture. And there is this idea that the agenda of the culture ought to be the agenda of the church. And this African brother is saying, that's not what the church is supposed to do. The church isn't supposed to do that. The church isn't to sell out to the culture, and we don't need to do that. So I think that was one of the most potent comments to come out of a lot of the debates. But I also think you're right, Barry. There were a lot of emotive appeals. You know, there was a lot of people getting up and grandstanding, and I've been, you know, my family's been part of the United Methodist Church for five generations, as if that has any actual bearing on the discussion in any way, shape, or form. And there was a huge push. I found this interesting, but not surprising. There was a huge push about what it means to appeal to American youth. You know, I remember Carl Truman once saying that, young people have never lacked making demands of the church to do things on their terms. But Carl Truman said, what is fascinating about our generation is the length we go to appease our youth. And that was very much on full display during the General Conference. Everybody saying, you know, our young people don't like this. This isn't supported by the majority of young people. Again, as if that should be an argument to change a very important stance on the church. So there were things like that that came up. Like I said, a lot of emotive arguments that I found very incoherent. I bet Scott, as a lawyer, would just love to hear some of those. But it was interesting, the appeal to emotion. And, you know, at the end of the day, why do people appeal to emotion? Why do they appeal to bloodlines and to hereditary issues? Well, I think it's because they've given up the authority of the Bible. And when you no longer have a biblical argument, you're going to grab anything you can to try to prove your point.
Yes. Yes. In the Christianity Today article that reported on the vote, there's a quote from a college student, a Methodist student who's obviously a gay young man, and just a example of what you're saying, Kyle. He says, we have brought people to Jesus saying they had not heard this message before. They didn't know God could love them because their churches said God did not. So this appeal to the emotions, to a God who's all-inclusive, all-loving, but no true justice or holiness. And so I did hear a lot of that in the different articles that I was reading.
At the same time, can I add one more quick comment?
Sure.
I'll try to make it quick. You know, it was interesting. What I found to be fascinating and a good cautious warning to everybody is that those who stood opposed to changing the position of the church often cited Matthew 19 and the biblical standard for what marriage is. But one of the things that those who were advocating for the all-inclusive church, one of the things they rightly pointed out were what you might call the moral and the interpretive inconsistencies in that denomination. And that doesn't, you know, inconsistencies don't make a conclusion, therefore, wrong. But it was very interesting the way in which these people, you know, so for instance, it was brought up, you know, how many of you bishops who are represented here, who are sitting on this floor, citing the first part of Matthew 19, how many of you have gotten an unbiblical divorce? And it was pointed out that this church had, the United Methodist Church has really weakened its stance on divorce. You know, one guy stood up, the pastor of the largest United Methodist Church, and he said, you know, you guys quote the scriptures at us, but you guys, we have found ways around this before. The Apostle Paul says clearly that women are not to teach in the church, but you know what? We allow them to teach. And the way we got around that is interpreting the text in light of its social context with a mind to more important biblical themes. And what is very crucial in that is pointing out these inconsistencies. And that really is a warning to the church. The Apostle Paul in Romans 2 says, you who boast about keeping the law, do you actually break the law? You know, and he says, because of you, God's name is blasphemed among the Gentiles because you say one thing, but you do another. And so I found that consistency issue to be very interesting in the debates as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, that's quite fascinating. Well, one of the things I wanted to have you interact with me a little bit on is a commentary given by Al Mohler regarding this. He wrote an article entitled Church History Made Before Our Eyes, United Methodists Make History, Affirm Biblical Standards of Sexuality. This is dated February 27th. And he's really quite excited about what took place in the United Methodist Church. He looked at the history of the denomination and just again all the tendencies it was moving toward becoming completely liberalized, and he really sees that this is a time where a good men and I guess women stood up and voted no and said no to this tidal wave of the homosexual and transsexual movements in our culture. And so he really saw this as a great victory for the church, and it seems to give him a lot of hope regarding the future of the denomination. I guess I wasn't quite as convinced, but I wanted to see what you guys thought. I sent that article over to you. Did you get an opportunity to look at it, and what are some of your thoughts regarding what the good Dr. Mohler had to say?
I did get a chance to look at it. I didn't read it with a, you know, closely. I skimmed it. I perused it. What I find interesting is, and you know, certainly there is reason to celebrate, to be thankful that the church voted the way it did. But I would be a lot less enthusiastic about the outcome as Dr. Mohler is. I don't see it as a big victory. I see it as a battle that was won. The battle of the day was won, but there's still a huge war that's being fought. And I don't think you can determine the outcome of this war based upon one small battle, which was a very close battle, and one which America, you know, the church in America sided with the wrong side, to be quite mm-hmm. frank.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you, Kyle?
Yeah, I would agree with Scott. I would not be as optimistic, you know, especially as I listened and watched some of these things coming out. This is a good decision, and I applaud the final decision. Mm-hmm. You know, the United Methodist Church now, for a number of years, has been surprising me. It was in 2016, they rolled back their support of Roe versus Wade. Ever since the Supreme Court had made that decision, the UMC had supported that decision. And in 2016, they retracted their support of it. Now we have this, where the church, by a pretty thin margin, but still, not only, I should add, not only doubled down on the current wording of their law and order, but they actually tightened the restrictions. In that they have given a timeline and a deadline for those who are gay clergy, those who perform same-sex marriage, they've given them a bit of a timeline to get out of the church. And so I really don't want to lose sight. I do applaud the final decision. Mm-hmm. But where the rubber is going to meet the road is if this denomination will now not lack the courage of their conviction. And I think that's where I get fearful. Declare, and this is not something particular to a Methodist church. Presbyterian churches struggle with it as well. We look really good on paper. But do we always apply that then? Do we consistently carry that out? And that's where my big concern for the Methodist church is now. will they lack the courage of their conviction? Will they actually work to remove from the church membership and clergy those who promote this? And I guess time will tell. I don't want to be overly pessimistic, but I do have my doubts.
Yeah, I think that was what was bothering me as I read again Dr. Moeller's article. There's, again, a lot to be encouraged by, as you men are saying. But as he says in his article, openly gay pastors serve in pulpits. One conference of the UMC is led by an openly gay bishop, all in open defiance of the Book of Discipline. And I guess I look at what happened, and they said, no, we're not going to affirm the same-sex marriage. And you who don't agree with that are going to have to figure out what to do. And there's this idea in his article that there'll probably be a schism, and most likely the conservatives will hold on to the UMC while the liberals leave. And I guess it's that part that I struggle with, because just regarding the nature of evil, you know, there are numerous seminaries that are United Methodist seminaries where you have men in power, you have these bishops that have power, and it's not the nature of evil to abdicate power. It's the nature of evil to hold on to it and to keep fighting until they get their way. I remember years ago reading Charles McElhaney's book, When the Wicked Seize a City. And it's his documentation of being a pastor in San Francisco and watching the gay and homosexual agenda advance itself in the community. And he said that their whole goal was to win over a community to their agenda, develop a stronghold there, and then from there branch out and infiltrate all areas of society. And you read that book and then you realize their manifestos come true. They've done what they wanted to do. And I just don't see that these people are going to voluntarily leave, I guess. Again, evil holds on to power. It loves power. And I just don't see it, especially here. I guess I'm thinking in the United States, unless there's some disciplinary action where they are removed from their offices. I guess I just don't have that type of optimism that I got from his article.
Yeah, you know, I think another factor in that, just thinking about the polity of the United Methodist Church, I think one of the big hurdles, and I wouldn't expect Al Mohler, who's a Southern Baptist with no real interconnection, to maybe go there immediately, but the United Methodist Church, all property and assets of church are owned by the denomination. To leave the denomination is to abandon property. And so not only, you know, do you have this theological struggle, it becomes a very economic struggle as well. I don't think it's going to be as easy as these people. It's not as easy as them just saying, we no longer want to be associated with the United Methodist Church. We're going to go on. It is going to be a battle and a struggle for who controls the denomination.
Right. And the sad thing is I do believe, as you experienced there in Winchester, Kyle, that there are warm-hearted evangelical people in the pews in many places across the country in the United Methodist Church. I have a dear neighbor, a widower, who's in that denomination, and it's just been sad to watch him. He's just heartbroken over the fact they're even voting on it and then struggling to know what he should do, even in light of the vote, just seeing what, you know, again, seeing the handwriting on the wall. So that's the thing that we have to just keep in mind as we talk about this in a national level, a political level, an ecclesiastical level, is that the people that are under these false shepherds, they're the ones that end up getting hurt, misled, and their money's being used for wicked things. And so it does, you know, this is an episode where we're talking about a serious matter that we also need to make sure that as we talk about it, that we're on the one hand, not going into an area of pride where we think we're better because we're not maybe suffering from that or struggling with that issue in our own ecclesiastical setting. But really, on the other hand, we should really be in prayer for the people, the sheep that are being so impacted and many people being misled just by the very fact that they're having these kinds of conversations, you know, debating whether homosexuality is evil or good is a sign of our times and how far we've really fallen from the truth. And so we really need to be grieving over this even as we discuss it. Well, we're about to come to our end of time here. Is there any other thoughts or questions you want to raise as we wrap this episode up, guys?
And the one thing I find very interesting about this is, while this seems like an isolated event, it's something that we need to be preparing for as a nation, that we're going to see this more and more, and we need to learn how to deal with it. You know, as you've alluded to, Barry, evil doesn't like to give up power. Well, it also likes to spread and use other means. And so we're going to see this kind of attack on faithful churches, or semi-faithful churches, I should say. And we need to be able to respond. We need to be able to give counsel to neighbors. I know this isn't anything that, aside from Kyle, kind of in a secondary way, it didn't affect us at all, but it will. Mm-hmm. And I think we need to take the lessons from this this vote and be prepared to help our neighbor when they do struggle and when this comes to their church.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree. We're not necessarily completely related to, this isn't completely related to the UMC decision, but right now as we're recording this, the Allegheny County Council, where the seminary is looking at a measure to outlaw any type of therapy that would be trying to convince young people that they're not gay or they're not of a different sex than the one that they're born with. And we have a counseling center. So if they pass that, we could be held in contempt of that law just by the fact that we're counseling people against same-sex desires and things of that nature. So the fact when the church begins to lose its light and savor as the salt it's supposed to be, it does begin to crowd us out, so to speak, as the world just presses in all the more tightly on us. So I really agree with what you're saying, Scott. Kyle, you had a thought.
Well, I was just going to follow up. Scott, I love the emphasis on helping our neighbor. Carl Truman just gave some lectures out at Westminster Seminary in California, and he had a lecture last night called Plastic People in a Liquid World. Which is, I'm just jealous. I wish I could come up with titles like that. But one of the points that he makes, so Carl Truman has dedicated a significant amount of time as a historian to what are the undercurrents and why is our culture expressing itself with this sexual deviance the way that it is in our day and age. It's a brilliant lecture. Carl Truman is brilliant. But one of the comments that he noted that really struck me is that, you know, Carl says he thinks the epidemic is of such proportions that we will not come up with a global or a national answer to the problem that is facing us. Ultimately, we have to work locally. And he throws the responsibility on local churches to do what they can with their neighbors to bring the truth of God to bear on these questions and on this cultural situation. And I thought that was very observant. So I like the way that you said that it begins with ministering to our neighbors. And I think that's very true. Local congregations need to see this as a local issue and to begin to own it and speak biblically to it.
Mm-hmm. And really, again, going back to the fact that just in the argumentation there on the floor, that some of the proponents of homosexuality and transsexuality were pointing to the lack of regard for marriage, for instance, we just got to really work hard in our local congregations on holiness among our young people and a solid biblical marriages and just those foundational things that the church should really be upholding during this time. And so I think that's perhaps the application we'll draw for this particular episode, given the fact that we're running out of time. So we do want to thank you for joining us on this episode of 3GT. If you'd like to learn some more about our podcast, you can go over to 3gt.xyz where you can hear recent podcasts, or you can go all the way back to the first one. I don't know if you want to do that or not, but you can do that if you'd like. And you could also support us there. There are ways to give, and we do appreciate it when you support us. So thank you for joining in on this episode of 3GT.